and Norm Shealy.
NormShealy.com.
You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Hello, everyone. This is Eva Herr, and thanks for listening to Infinite Consciousness tonight. Tonight I have a guest, Robert Call, and we're going to talk about something other than alternative medicine and science tonight. Bob wrote a fabulous book called Solitude about his travels to Patagonia for a year living in solitude. So it's been a wonderful book for me. I look forward to those few minutes I read this book every night when I go to bed, and I just thought you guys might be interested in hearing it too. Welcome, Bob, and thanks for coming on my show.
Thanks, Eva. It's good to be here. I appreciate the invitation.
I think I've told you, I love this book. I look forward to spending time, even if it's only two or three pages a night, reading this book. It'll be one that has worn pages for many years to come.
Oh, good. That's neat.
So tell us a little bit about you before we get started, and where people can find you and where they can find your book or email questions if they have any.
Well, they can find me at the beach some of the time, or up camping or whatever, but they on the web, my website is bobkull.org, bobkull.org, and there's lots of photographs and some video on there of where I spent the year in almost the tip of South America, in extreme southern Chile on the Pacific coast on a little island, and it's an incredibly beautiful area where I was. So when we're talking about this, people can kind of look at the photographs and get more of a visual idea of what it was like.
What led you to do this? I want you to give a little bit of your history before we get into your travels, so they'll understand why you did what you did.
Well, I'm not entirely sure I understand it, at least cognitively. I have a sense of it, intuitive sense of it. And one of my senses is that we can tell all kinds of stories to explain why we do what we do in life. And those stories are endless, and as far as I can tell, they're always tentative. So fundamentally, I just feel a call into solitude, and I have since I was a kid. I've always loved to just kind of get away from other people and hunker down alone in nature. And part of it possibly is because there was a lot of tension in my family when I was growing up and between my family and the neighbors. My father, right around the time I was born, became a real fundamentalist Christian, and my mother didn't, and so there was that tension in the family, and there was a lot of tension between my father preaching at me and trying to jam me into the mold of how he thought I should be as a Christian, and plus lots of other tensions. And so in some sense, possibly, I just felt that the only place I could really relax into myself without having to keep up a guard all the time and kind of a pretension was by myself in sitting alone in nature. And I think that's part of it. But there's also a real positive aspect to it. Of there's a sense of wonder and expansion that happens when I'm alone in nature. It's hard sometimes. Because one of the things that we often avoid is the dark shadow parts of ourselves, and that stuff tends to come up in nature. And so it's both an opportunity and a challenge. And so I just started going when I was young. One of the things my parents did share was a love of nature, and so we would also go out picnicking and stuff like that together as a family, and that was one of the very few times within the family that it was comfortable. And then as when I left home, I started spending more time and alone. And then in my late 20s, I went and spent 3 months by myself. And at that time, I didn't know what I was getting into, and I almost didn't survive. I almost lost it and went crazy. But I did survive, and there were some just amazing transformations of consciousness that happened. And I discovered that I wasn't who I thought I was, and it was just this infinite world of flowing possibility. And so at that point, I thought, someday I'd like to spend a year by myself in the wilderness and just really see where that goes during a year. So that took a long time. I did a lot of other things in between before finally it just all the conditions came together to go and spend a year by myself.
How did you... You were the only person there on the island that you know of, right?
Oh, there was nobody else for sure. Within 100 miles, there was just nobody. It was a tiny little island where I was. It was probably 150 meters by 250, something like that. And it was, you know, nestled in an archipelago of other islands and fjords and peninsulas, but there's just nobody there. There's no airplanes fly over and no boats, no kayaks, there's no sign of mining or logging. Just never a sound of an internal combustion engine. So occasionally on the other side of a line, a peninsula of hills, there's a channel there, and probably 4 or 5 day boats a day might go up and down that channel. So that was probably 20 miles from where I was. But other than that, the only people I saw during the year is when the government actually specifically came in to visit, and I think they just wanted to check out my camp and see that I would survive the winter. The winter where I was very harsh.
So it wasn't like we imagine when we think someone goes to an island in the Pacific.
No, no, it was very different from that. They had warned me before I went that the weather is extreme, and I thought I knew weather from living on the in the Pacific Northwest, just where I live. But it was just really, really hard climate down there. It's the windiest place on Earth, and they measure rain in meters, and it's just very extreme climate. But that's why there's nobody there, because it's a very difficult place to stay alive in.
So how did you make it happen? You took a boat with the Navy, dropped you off there, and dropped
supplies? Yeah, logistics were challenging. I mean, if you just imagine not going to a store for the next year, not getting any more supplies, that whatever you're going to need, you have to take in with you, which is what I did. And so, and not only, but I needed to build a camp for myself as well. I was going into the wilderness where there wasn't a shelter, so I had to build a shelter and all the stuff involved in that. So the logistics of preparing, I made lists for a couple of years just to try to minimize what I'd forget, because if you don't have it, you don't have it. And then I shipped a couple of crates of stuff from Vancouver, British Columbia, down to southern Chile, and flew down and met the crates down there. And I spent another month and a half or so in a town down there shopping, buying additional stuff, and trying to arrange transport from that town out to where I wanted to go. And I wasn't sure where I wanted to go, but talking with locals, I kind of figured out I wanted to be at least 100 miles from the nearest small town, because otherwise I feel like I'm kind of in suburbia if I'm any closer than that. There's a sense of hanging on the edge of civilization, and I wanted to make a clean break and just experience what it would be like just to be in the ancient, you know, center of the world and not be hooked up to civilization. Of course, I took myself with me and gear with me, so I was in some sense carrying civilization with me.
And you took a cat.
I did. I took a cat, yeah. It wasn't my plan, but the government down there said that if I was planning to eat shellfish, there's a lot of red tide, which is a toxin that shellfish absorb through plankton bloom. It's in the States as well, and that they have a government testing program, but of course I wouldn't have access to the results. So what locals do, that you know traditionally have done, is they feed suspect shellfish to a cat, and then if the cat dies, they don't eat it themselves. So that was the original idea of taking the cat, and of course it didn't work because we got really, really close. And so instead of cat testing shellfish for me, I was catching fish for the cat.
How did you live? What'd you live in?
I made a shelter. I was doing this on a really tight budget. I didn't have a high budget, and so everything I could, all my tools and fishing gear and camping gear, I had either bought secondhand or I'd had for many years been using it. And so one of the things I wanted, and because I was taking everything into this little island where I eventually went, the Chilean Navy, I finally managed to hook up with the Chilean Navy, and they took me in. But I tried to keep the supplies as cheap as possible, the building materials, and as also as not weigh any more than necessary. And so I took in lumber to make a frame that I built up on pilings, because the ground there is incredibly wet. The water table's 3 or 4 inches below the surface when it's not actively raining. When it is actively raining, it's above the surface. And so I built up on pilings a couple of feet above the ground. And then I used plywood. I took plywood for a floor and continued to build a wooden frame and a very lightweight plywood roof, single water roof, so not a peaked roof, but just the cabin was higher in the front than the back, so it was just drained, the rain drained down to the back of it. And then I covered the outside of the shelter with tarp and the inside of the frame with clear plastic, so it created a dead air space that acted as insulation. And I had a wood-burning stove to keep warm and a propane stove to cook on.
What did you do for water?
It rained a huge amount. And so I hooked a gutter, and it was always my plan. I hooked a gutter to the back of the cabin, and the water that drained off the roof, I collected it in a 50-gallon drum and had that just outside my door on the porch. And so that was my drinking water. It was plenty of water for drinking and bathing and washing clothes. It rained a lot, so water wasn't a problem.
So was solitude, total solitude, what you thought it would be? And I'd like for you to talk a little bit about what you learned about yourself and what you learned, quite honestly, with Kat, because that was just such an interesting observation, the way you described what happened with you and that cat.
Mm-hmm. Well, the expectations of what it would be like, I knew that if I went in with expectations, it would be very problematic. And so my intention was, this in part was field work for a PhD. And so I started my undergraduate education when I was 40 after a motorcycle wreck, and I got part of my leg ripped off and ended up with a prosthetic leg. And so I started school late, and it was quite problematic in some ways, because there was a real sense that what mattered to me most as a human being, there was no room for that in the university. It was just all about learning facts and theories. And I had to kind of check myself at the door. So there was a real sense of disconnect between what I was learning in the classroom and what I was learning in nature when I was out, or with myself when I was meditating. And so when I went on for a PhD, I decided that I wouldn't check myself at the door anymore, that this PhD was going to include all aspects of who I am, both my heart and my mind and all the emotions and my body, and everything was going to be part of this project. And so partly my intention was to treat my research, my field research, as sort of a hybrid between a meditation retreat, a self-retreat, and a research project. So I didn't go in with a theoretical frame that I was either trying to prove or disprove, but my commitment, academic commitment, was to spend a year on this island and pay attention. Whatever happened, just to pay attention and record it in a journal without trying to prove anything or disprove anything. Because of that, and also because of meditation practice, I knew it was really foolish to go in with expectations. And yet I did go in with expectations about how this year would be. And I based those expectations largely on the 3 months I'd spent alone in my 20s. And the problem was that I wasn't basing my expectations on what happened during the 3 months when I was in my 20s, but rather on an idealized, mythologized memory of that. And so I had this kind of storyline in my head that I would go in and there would be, you know, a difficult 2 or 3 months while I got settled in, and then there would be this shift from what I call small mind into big mind. It's Zen terminology. And I would just spend the rest of the year blissed out and woven into the universe and enlightened. And even though I knew it was silly to have that expectation, I did have it. And so the year wasn't what I expected it to be, because it was much more real than I expected it to be. And so the overarching goal was to discover this enlightenment thing and learn how to control that shift from this kind of small ego-bound mind into the experience of being woven into the universe, and learn how to control that in myself, and then come back and be able to teach that to others. You know, there's lots of groovy gurus in the world, and I thought, well, maybe I'll become one of them. And so that didn't work. You know, it turned out that I had a real misconception of what I was looking for, and so I had this notion that enlightenment is something, some sort of permanent end state to gain, and it may be. I don't know. But for me, so far in my life, it's not. And it seems like that interpretation of Eastern mysticism is a real corruption of the process. And it's a twisting of the process into kind of a Western notion of progress and materialism. You know, setting everything up as something to get and hold on to and cling to. And so the process largely during the year was a process of having to let go over and over and over of my expectations of how I wanted things to be, and learn to little by little accept things as they actually were. And that had to do with the physical conditions of the climate, with my own physical pain. I was in a lot of physical pain a lot of the time. I was in a lot of emotional and spiritual pain a lot of the time. And so partly the pain was actual based on the difficulty of the conditions, but a lot of it was comparing what was actually going on to what I thought should be going on and what I wanted to be going on, and that created that additional tension. And so there was a sense of Cat being a really profound teacher for me, that solitude in and of itself is the context and the main teacher. Simply spending time alone is school in a sense. But within that, there were three other really, really profound teachers: the wind and the rain and Cat. And the wind taught me about surrendering, that over and over I would make plans to go for firewood or to go out fishing or go exploring, and the wind would just come slamming in. And I was living in a lot of anxiety around the wind, that I'd get out someplace in my small inflatable boat and a storm would roll in unexpectedly and capsize me or leave me stranded. And so there was a huge amount of just anxiety around that, and frustration about not being able to control my life in any way, but just really being, it felt like at the mercy of the wind. And there was a sense early on of the wind, a capital W, as being a malevolent presence, actually intent on my annihilation, out to get me. And so there was that. One of the things of solitude is this exploration of and realization that this existential angst that is kind of built into the human mind, because we're aware as individuals we're not permanent. Everybody dies, and no matter how much we try to deny that, and possibly, you know, depending on your view of things, but from my perspective, a lot of the stories we tell about what happens after we die may simply be a desire to continue to exist as an entity in the face of everything we see around us. And so for me, this year was a process of letting go of myself over and over and over, and allowing this self-surrender into what was going on, the flow of the universe. And so this anxiety and fear I would project out onto the wind, that the wind was out to get me, rather than experiencing it fully just within myself as the experience of fear in itself. And so during the year, there was a part of the transformation was coming to just allow myself to experience the darker emotions directly rather than projecting them out onto the world, because there's nothing much to project them onto. You know, often we live in a world of projection. So the wind taught me about that, and the rain also taught me a huge amount about learning to love. At first, the constant rain was just deeply frustrating and depressing. And then slowly, as I relaxed into it, the sound of water became a really intense mantra for me. It just following the sounds of the rain on the roof and in the rock pools and the surf against the rocks and the trickling water. There was this almost constant sound of flowing water that carried me deeper and deeper within. And in that inner place, the experience of love really started to blossom and glow and fill the world at times.
I know from your book, did I interrupt you?
Sure. That's okay, though.
Now, did
you
wanted,
I didn't get around to Cat, and you wanted to. You were asking about Cat, so
I thought you'd finish.
Let me just
I'm
quickly
sorry.
Go to Cat. And Cat really taught me about my own demons. They're, you know, often we try to avoid our own shadow material. Intellectually, we know that as human beings, we're capable of really dark behavior because other human beings do it. And given the proper circumstance, we're capable of it too. But there's one thing to know it intellectually and something else to really experience it nakedly. And in solitude, you're really faced with yourself. It's difficult to look away. And so Cat was doing things that were just flipping me out. He would get right in the middle of what I was doing, whatever I was working, I'd get right in the middle, and I'd put him aside, and he'd get right back in the middle. He's an incredibly stubborn, willful creature, unlike me, of course. and you know, after about three times, I'd just throw him into the mud. And then he'd seem to get the message, oh, I better not get back in the middle. Or I'd have spent a lot of time slowly sneaking up on birds to photograph them, and he'd come marching by and chase them away. But the most frustrating was he cried a huge amount. He was the most vocal cat I've ever heard. And I'm somewhat allergic to cats, and so I decided that I spent most of my time outside, and during that time we were always together. It didn't matter how stormy it was. He was right out there with me in the wind and the rain, getting soaking wet. It was incredible. And if I was sitting on the porch, he was next to me or in my lap. So we spent a huge amount of time together. But when I went inside and closed the door for the night, then it was kind of my time. And he would get lonely, and on the porch, I had a real nice box set up for him, all insulated and everything, so he wasn't cold. But he'd get lonely, and he'd just be out there crying hour after hour. And I'm trying to meditate or think, and it would just flip me out. And so there were these things that he was doing that I didn't approve of. And, you know, my goodness, this is my cat. He shouldn't be doing this to me. So on the other hand, he seemed to have the sense that I was his human and that I wasn't behaving appropriately as his human. And so we had this real philosophical difference about things. And over and over, my sister, who's married to a veterinarian, had told me, oh, cats are easy to train. You just squirt them with water. And so I tried that, but of course this is a cat that's going out into storms with me, getting totally soaking wet, so that didn't work. And so I started throwing cups of water at him, and he seemed to enjoy it, like he'd dodge. And I started throwing buckets of water at him, and I was getting pretty crazy about this, you know. And some really, really dark stuff came up in me. I would kick him sometimes or swat him, and each time I'd lose my temper and just be lost in rage. I was just appalled by what I was doing, and I vowed that I wasn't going to speak to him angrily or smack him or throw water at him, and then next time I would lose it and I would do it all over again. And as a background to this, I was in a lot of physical pain, and so living kind of on the edge of control a lot of the time. And so it was really difficult to have to face this stuff on myself. And so over time, there was a real sense of gratitude as well that he had shown me these parts of myself in a really direct way. And so, you know, finally there came to be this sense of of letting go, one of the reasons I was so angry with him about his crying is I treated him as a possession, that he was my cat, that he should do what I wanted him to do. And I came to realize that I was treating myself the same way, that I had this sense that I should feel and do how I thought. You know, this whole systemic organism of who is this me is supposed to behave, belong to and obey the ego me. And so slowly there was a surrender of that attitude and came to treat my inner world in the same way I was learning to relate to the outer world, that on the outer world there was rain and there was wind and I wasn't in control and I needed to learn to flow with all those changes. And the same with my inner life, that there were inner storms, that, you know, when things got dark inwardly, instead of taking it as a personal affront, that it should only be light and joyous inside, I started accepting and allowing myself to just experience all those different changes that I was experiencing inwardly.
So how I would imagine that after you got settled in, that you had to do with mind, you had to deal with mind chatter. You know, why did this happen? What did this do? What am I going to do? What am I going to do about this? Or why did this happen? Or why am I having this? Or why did I do that? How did you deal with that? What did you learn from that? Did you stop that? Were you able to stop it? Did you face it? Did you submit to it? Tell me about that.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. It was a huge part of the year, kind of this what-if mind. That's kind of how I label it, what if. You know, this anxiety that arises, what if. And it's all based on leaving the present moment and imagining some future. What if this happens? And there were different ways that I dealt with it. Most fundamentally, it was being aware of it as much as I could, really being aware of that process of when that mind would arise and the experience of it and the pain that it caused. So that was one aspect of it. And the other was, you know, a number of very difficult things happened during the year, and mostly they were unexpected. The boat flipped, and I fell and tore up the rotator cuffs in both shoulders. I had to pull a tooth. And none of these things were expected. And so there was a sense of, wait a minute, you know, I'm spending this enormous amount of time what-ifing myself, imagining scenarios and how I might deal with them. And mostly those scenarios never happen. And the things that are really challenging sort of blindside me. You know, they come totally unexpectedly. The other piece of the what-if mind is a fear that I won't be able to deal with things. That's kind of the root, as far as I can tell, cause of it. You know, trying to imagine scenarios, rehearse them, and imagine how to deal with them so to be prepared at the moment. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with doing that. I think that that's a very useful exercise to do. The problem is the emotional load of anxiety that we carry instead of just being pragmatic planning. You know, this whole emotional load of fear and that we carry into it. And so there was the realization when I started really looking and going, okay, I didn't expect this to happen, and it did happen, and I dealt with it in the moment. And over and over. And so that eased a little bit the what-if anxiety, but it was still there. It's still in my life today to some extent. You know, it comes and goes. But I think as we live and if we pay attention to our living, we can gain some space around that. So it doesn't completely go away, but there's not such an identification with it. These kinds of mind states and emotional states flow through. And we don't try to push them away or cling, but just allow ourselves to experience them and let them go. So one of the real challenges of deep solitude is there's no one to depend on. There's no one to call. There's no one to, you know, get counseling from. And so there's a real sense of needing to take care of business. And there's a couple of, simplistically, seems to me that there are three different ways of dealing with difficult emotions. And one is to try to suppress them, which is, you know, what we do a lot of the time. We just look away. We stay busy. We turn on the TV. We drink another cup of coffee. We read a book. We read a spiritual book. Anything rather than simply face ourselves and be with ourselves. The second, and that doesn't work in solitude very well because it's pretty hard to maintain that avoidance pattern when you're by yourself. The second thing that doesn't work very well is to experience those things, but you getting swept away, you know, because you can go crazy. I mean, there's some real risk in spending long periods of time alone. It's not trivial. And so there's, you know, when you start exploring deeply, there's always the possibility of getting swept away in some of these dark places. And that
so how did you come back when you would get in one of those on the edge like that? How did you come back?
Well, the skillful means is to not go there. I mean, to experience things but maintain some equanimity. And so an awareness of the risks and, you know, allow myself to experience stuff. But when I felt like I was being overwhelmed, is to back away. And then, you know, there are ways to avoid and, you know, get busy doing something. And so it was kind of a dance of going deeper. And then if I felt like I was losing it, coming back out of it. There are also other ways. You know, I've now had a lot of experience in with it. And so, a fair amount of meditation practice and just the basic teaching is equanimity, is settle back in the moment and allow yourself to experience things without identifying with. And it's the identification with that creates the problems. And sometimes when I did get swept away, I would ask the inner light to, you know, for guidance and for help. Or I would just spend time listening to the water, settle into water sounds or the incredible beauty. And so because, you know, being swept away is largely a process of circular thinking. You know, there's an emotion linked to a thought, and then the thought generates more emotion, and the emotion reinforces the thought. And so it's kind of like a positive feedback loop that winds up. And so you need to not get sucked into that loop. And the most skillful way is to allow the loop to do it, what it's doing without being caught up in it and just go, yeah, wow, look at that, it's happening, but not feed it, not continue to throw energy into it. But if you're caught, then, you know, there needs to be a way to break that and step out of it. And for me, beauty is one of the ways of doing that, is just to really pay attention to the world around me. And so it's really analogous to scuba diving in some sense. I like to dive. I used to be an instructor, and I broke all the rules and would dive by myself and dive alone and deep. And so there's a real sense of wonder in diving alone. There's another otherworldly sense. And you know, but there's a part, you can get real spaced out down there, but there's, you know, kind of a survival part of mind that's got to be monitoring your time that you've been down there and how deep you are and the supply of air in the tank. And so, solitude's like that too. You need to have a part of your mind that maintains the survival awareness and not lose that because, you know, it's risky.
I'm going to try to word this question as best I can. Language is a problem, you know, when you talk about this kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah, absolutely is.
You know, we're in duality.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that constant force of yin and yang when it comes to human beings and another, you know, the yin and the yang, mm-hmm. the man and the woman. And love, what did you learn about that and being away from the possibility of having love or no love or experience with another human being and know that you couldn't have it? And what did you learn? Because I know you have problems with that, with,
mm-hmm.
with relationships. You talk about that in your book.
Right.
What did you learn from that and how did you deal with it? Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a couple of levels. One of the things is just the sexuality, you know, of being away from sexuality for that long. And that wasn't a problem because, you know, I was over 50, and so the hormones weren't raging as much as they had when I was younger. And also, for whatever reason, not necessarily my choice, or it doesn't necessarily feel like a conscious choice. I've been celibate for quite a while. That's just how it's been in my life. And so the sexuality wasn't a big issue. One of the fascinating things, going back to my late 20s, when, you know, I was largely filled with lust, as most 20-year-olds are, and I went in solitude for 3 months, and it was amazing. Sex just disappeared, and it disappeared so completely that I didn't even know it had disappeared. It was just gone. You know, that whole tension about being horny and all that stuff was just gone. And it wasn't until I came out and saw a woman that it all came flooding back in, and I realized how gone it had been. You know, I wasn't out there going, wow, this is really cool. I'm not feeling horny. It was gone so much that that didn't even come up. It was just gone. And afterward, when I reflected back, I went, wow, was that ever relaxing? That was very interesting. And so this time there was a little bit of that, but not very much. So what there was more was a kind of feeling, a woundedness about not being in a paired relationship, that sense of something profound missing in my life. I was and remain in a really close relationship with my friend Patty, who came to spend a month with me to help me in the transition after I'd been there a year. But our relationship is non-sexual, and so there's a certain something, and it's probably way down in the biological roots, that longs for this partnering with somebody, an intimate partnering. And so there was a missing of that, and I don't think that I resolved it. It was just there. It was just part of the experience. Loneliness, moving up another level, was a profound part of the experience, and it was really an interesting exploration. This sense of loneliness and what this means. And one of the things that really struck me is how often we equate feelings of aloneness and solitude. You know, our culture tends to see it as really negative. So many of us spend so much time alone, and there's this real sense of alienation connected to it. And so there was, you know, I explored all of that a lot. And I came to realize that solitude in and of itself doesn't equate with loneliness, that loneliness is one of the experiences that we experience as human beings, whether we're around other people or not. And so for me, solitude, the sense of aloneness, generates an enormous space of peacefulness and spaciousness and stillness that I tend not to experience when I'm around other people. And so from that place, solitude is incredibly joyful. It opens, you know, I'm much stiller when I'm in solitude, both mentally and physically. And out of that stillness arises for me the sense of the sacred, the sense of wonder that the world is vibrantly alive and spirit-filled. And it's difficult for me to directly experience that when I'm around other people. I can remember it and know it, but to actually experience that sense. And along with that comes the direct experience of being woven into the universe, of this sense of oneness, being part of the flow. And so what I found really fascinating was waking up to felt like a quote-unquote fact that that the kind of core of my loneliness is not missing someone else, but missing myself, of having lost my inner connection with myself and with spirit. And that's where that sense of disconnect and alienation arises from that. It, you know, again, I tend to project it onto other people in the same way I can project my fear outward. I can project that experience of loneliness outward. And so what was really fascinating was these inner cycles of feeling not lonely at all, completely fulfilled in the moment, filled with joy and wonder and woven in, and the trees and the birds and the sea and the sky. This was my home, and it was pulsatingly alive and caring for me and touching me, and just this profound relationship, and even feeling woven in and connected with the people in my life that weren't present but that were out there. And then, for no reason that I can discern, that would pass, and there would be this sense of alienation, of just being cut off from the world around me and feeling disconnected from everything, from the people that weren't there and from myself. And it's like, wow, what just happened here? Nothing's changed in my world. You know, normally we blame such things on some change in external circumstance. It was just like, well, wait a minute. Nothing has happened here. But all of a sudden, I'm feeling really cut off and vulnerable in the face of a malevolent universe again. And so that was part of what I wanted to avoid and get rid of in the experience. And that's when I say of learning to accept my inner weather, it was learning to live with those changes and treat them as weather that I wasn't in control of, and just allow the cycles to move through me. And in that allowing, those times of darkness and alienation lost a huge amount of their power. So there was a sense when I would experience that, especially, you know, the alienation and frustration and depression, when I would allow myself to just sink into that, really, instead of trying to avoid it or do something with it or experience it so that it would pass, get rid of all the so that's, and just say, I'm just going to experience what this is. And sinking into it, it would often just open out into this sense of tenderness and joy in the world again. So there was that learning that the way to work with a lot of these difficult states is to really allow ourselves to experience them in a very gentle and full way.
You also talked in your book a lot about how, I want to say, like, rewards and punishments almost with your food. And what did that do for you to let yourself have a piece of chocolate or a cup of coffee? And why would you pull back from that? What would that do for you?
And
the material things that you have.
Right, right. Well, one of the things that also struck me is, you know, in Buddhist practice, there's this sense of letting go of desires. And it really struck me what a radical notion that is, to let go of all desires. Because, you know, it's one thing to let go of gluttony or lust or drugs or you know, the desire for power or for wealth. But when you start looking at subtle desires, like the desire to experience beauty, the desire to experience love and friendship and a warm fire, and, you know, it's just like, wow, that's an incredibly radical stance to take. And, you know, it's like simply allow ourselves to experience whatever is, what's actually going on in the here and now. And one of the things I discovered, incredibly, is how much time I, and I think most people, spend denying that things are what they are. It's astonishing. You know, our whole notion of cultural progress, these utopian ideals we have, the idea of getting enlightened, the idea of getting a better job, the idea of getting a better relationship, the idea of whatever. There's nothing wrong with you know, effort to bring about change. That's not the issue. The issue is that often built into that is this denial of what actually is. You know, we cling to what we want something to be, which is different from what actually is. And so this, we're constantly reaching out to make things different for something we don't have, and pushing away or denying what we do have. I don't want to be this way. I don't want to experience myself this way. I don't want to weigh what I weigh. I don't want to look how I look. I don't want to think the thoughts I'm thinking. I don't want to feel the feelings I'm feeling. Just on and on and on. And it's like, wow, this is astonishing. This truly is insane. To deny what is, the world will always be exactly what it is in every single moment. It's always changing, and we can work to bring about change, but in every instant, things are what they are. And it's so hard to get that at a really deep level, to really, really get that. But, oh yeah, things are what they are. They will always be what they are. And when we don't do that, we live in this dislocation, that we're not actually living in the world as it is and in ourselves as we are. We've kind of set ourselves aside, and we're living in this kind of imaginary existence. And it's not very rich. Life passes us by. And so part of the reason I was using food was when experiences would come up, emotions or physical pain would come up, I didn't want to experience. I'd have a little taste treat to generate some energy or to, you know, move my mood a little bit. And coffee was a huge one. You know, I would be feeling kind of logy and drowsy, and I'd have a cup of coffee, and I'd put cocoa in it and sugar and milk, and it was like a dessert, and I'd feel on top of the world for about 20 minutes. It was just like, whoa, this is good. And then I'd crash again, and I'd go to sleep, you know, and I'd wake up later, and I'd go, oh, man, it sucks, and I'd go have another cup of coffee. And so one of the first things I let go of was I said, you know, I really want to see what happens to move out of this up and down cycle of this, you know, stimulation and crashing and stimulation. And then another big part of it was for 3 months I gave up reading. I put my books away. I'd once in a while read a little bit of just a paragraph or two of something to kind of catalyze me, but I stopped reading as an escape. And I didn't take a bunch of novels, but even, you know, factual stuff, spiritual stuff, psychological stuff, philosophy, all that stuff in some ways is an escape from what actually is. And so I gave up reading, and that was scary, to just be with myself 24/7. And as part of that, I also gave up taste treats. So I gave up eating chocolate. I gave up fruit. I had dried fruit. And, I gave up honey. I gave up the bread and butter and jam I was eating. And basically, I just went to straight subsistence, rice and beans and fish and oatmeal. And tried to just, you know, stop using food as an escape. It was just one, you know, stop using reading as an escape and food as an escape, and just to attempt to really explore as deeply as I could what was going on and around and within me.
We have about 5 minutes. Tell me, what did you bring back with you, and how was it for you to, integrate into the world? And what did you bring back with you that changed the way you lived in your world? We got about 5 minutes.
Right. Well, in some sense, I didn't bring anything back. You know, that was the thing, and in some ways, it was whether it's a real discovery or a tentative one. You know, everything's tentative. Is that there is nothing to bring back. You know, there's a sense that we're constantly trying to get something, and a feeling of coming back kind of empty-handed, and the recognition there's really nothing to get. So that was pretty interesting. In some ways, my lifestyle hasn't changed a lot, except that I've softened. One of the things about solitude is, in coming into deeper relationship with myself, I'm more available to relationship with other people. But I still spend a lot of time alone, and so in some ways I'm not very woven into our culture. There's that's going on. There was a real sense, one of the things, I teach an online course in systems thinking for an environmental education program, and one of the things out there was a real awareness of my relationship with the non-human world, and the sense that we're really disconnected from the biological world and ourselves, you know, our own biological being. So there was a sense of the need to not only think about ecological issues and our place in the world, but actually change the way we experience ourselves in the world and to feel, actually feel ourselves to be a part of the world, not just know it intellectually. So that was a pretty big change for me in coming back. And I think there's a sense of I'm just softer, and I don't know that I've gained any wisdom, but I think I just got the shit kicked out of me a lot. I don't have the same energy to resist everything. So there's a lot more acceptance. And I still go through all the stuff. You know, it's not that I'm fixed or anything like that. The process continues. But and just more of allowing things to be what they are and to really try to be more and more in the moment. And that because it seems to me that the kind of heart of the spiritual journey is to learning to be still. And out of that place of stillness, what we need to learn arises. And whether we call it somebody's teaching us or we're receiving messages or it simply arises from within, it's from that place of stillness and you know, listening that we learn what we need to know.
For words to be a problem, you have such an eloquent way of using them. I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed that book. Like I said, I never read anything twice, Bob, but this book will be one that I go through because it takes me away. So I encourage everybody to go take a look at Bob's book, and not only that, but look at his photographs. You won't believe what he was living till you really look at it. Your website's bobcall.org. Anything else you want to say before we go?
I don't think so. Just that I appreciate talking with you. It's been really nice, and I'm really glad that you've enjoyed the book and that you've taken time to read it, not rush through, because it's intended to invite the reader to come with me. It's not just a story about my year in solitude, but it's intended to invite readers to come with me and also to reflect on our own lives, wherever and however we're living. Because you know, I'm not heroic for having done this. It's just what I did. And so all of us are on a journey, and we can share that with each other. So,
well, thank you for doing what you did and for sharing it with us.
Well,
and
welcome.
I'm sure I'll talk to you many times.
I look
thank
forward
you.
To
it. Good
and
night,
I appreciate
Bob.
The invitation. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.